Committee on Judiciary, Wednesday, June 22nd, 1983, 5 p.m., Hearing Room A, work session and hearing.
Senate Judiciary Committee, please come to order. Senators Brown, Frye, Gardner, and Wires are present. Senator Cohen is excused. Senator Hendrickson, I expect, will be along momentarily, and also Senator Hamby. First bill today, starting to have a hearing on House Bill 2306.
This is, I put this all in 492.
I am Norman Winslow, appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. I am also a member of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Bar Association, the source out of which the proposed bill came out, and I happen to also be the one who initially presented the idea to the committee for consideration and approval later by the Bar Association at large, and its presentation to this body through the House. It grows out of the case of U.S. National Bank versus Smith, a case in which went all the way to the Supreme Court upon petition for review. It was a mortgage foreclosure in which approximately $3,000 attorney's fees were awarded the plaintiff, as well as foreclosure of the mortgage in the trial court. On appeal to the Court of Appeals, the mortgage foreclosure part was affirmed, but the attorney's fees were reduced to $750. The Court of Appeals felt that that change in the result was sufficient so that the appellant should recover attorney's fees on appeal, and they awarded attorney's fees on appeal based on the reduction of the attorney's fees in the trial court. Upon petition for review, the Supreme Court said that was wrong, and they went back to the basic statute, which...
How did the trial fees get reduced? Attorney fees get reduced at the trial?
I believe it was on a pleading question that I believe the plaintiff's attorney had inadvertently failed to ask for more than $750, and they reduced it on that procedural point, not on the issue of what might have been reasonable or the merits. But anyway, the Supreme Court, referring back to OS 20.096 and particularly subdivision 5 thereof, which says the prevailing party means the party in whose favor final judgment or decree is rendered, and they said in this case the plaintiff prevailed because they got the judgment on their mortgage foreclosure, and therefore the appellant, even though they obtained a reduction in attorney's fees, was not the prevailing party, and that the respondent was entitled to attorney's fees, a result which could easily have been come out differently. But Judge Denneke wrote a specially concurring opinion in which he pointed out that, at least in his opinion, the language of the statute defining prevailing party that I just quoted was very rigid, and that he felt the appellate courts should not be limited to that language, and frankly, I talked to him about it to see whether there was any consensus on the Supreme Court about how the bill, how the statute ought to be amended. He declined to do that, but he pointed out a former case, the case of Gowan versus Hyder, in which I happened to be personally involved. That's not important, but we got into a controversy in a multi-cause of action appeal dealing with costs, And the rule followed in Gowan versus Hyder was that an appellant who obtains a substantial modification of the decree on appeal is entitled to costs, even though a part of the case, there happened to be three causes of action in the case, even though one part of it was affirmed. And after considering that language and running it through the committee, we concluded that was as good language to carry out the intent and purpose of what we had in mind as anyone could come up with, and it is recommended on the basis of going through the state bar procedure with which you are generally familiar.
This only involves attorney fees under a contractual agreement that recites the prevailing party will receive attorney fees?
No, it generally covers attorney's fees on appeal, period.
So it's statutory as well as contractual?
Yes, that's right.
Does this affect a situation where then someone in an injury case had an award and say it was award for $20,000 and the Court of Appeals reduced that to $10,000, the defense could get an attorney fee under this language?
That's right, and a very similar illustration was referred to in the original opinion of the Supreme Court, not Judge Denneke. I think they took a figure of $100,000 plaintiff verdict reduced to $100,000, and they said, you follow the statute as it now exists, even a reduction of $100,000 judgment to $100, the plaintiff would still prevail. Your illustration is very similar. The one that's in the opinion is even a little more extreme than yours.
23.
I suppose mine betrays my bias, which my next question would be, isn't this going to be a court congester encouraging insurance companies to appeal every substantial award in the hopes they can get it reduced substantially and then justify their appeal to the insurance company based on that?
Well, I haven't had that particular question asked of me. My thinking about most appeals of personal injury awards are based on verdicts of juries, and in which it's either all or none unless you've got a situation involving a separation of the damages. I don't really believe that there's anything wrong with the bill in addressing that problem.
Senator Frey?
Well, I had another question, which I'll get to in a moment, but just to follow up with your question, Mr. Chairman, I do notice that the language makes it discretionary, so I would assume that the appellate court would use discretion in deciding, in that kind of a case, who is really the prevailing party. My question is, suppose you have a claim and, say, a set-off, where the plaintiff brings a claim, the defendant claims a set-off, and after the trial, both parties appeal. I mean, the plaintiff wins the judgment, but it wasn't as much as the plaintiff wanted, and the defendant was unhappy because the set-off wasn't enough, so they both appeal, and so the appellate court reduces the amount of the plaintiff's damages and also reduces the amount of the set-off. So in other words, both parties kind of got less than they came up on appeal were expecting, and that probably doesn't happen very often, but in that situation, I suppose, under this language, this discretionary language, the court...
Yes, I think you put your finger on it, that we are giving the appellate court discretion and getting away from what is a rigid rule, and the facts could vary quite a bit in terms of who might really have been the one who obtained the greater modification and therefore substantial modification under the language of the proposed amendment.
Well, I do know, Mr. Chairman, that case that was just mentioned has caused some consternation in the trial bar as to who really is the prevailing party anymore. And it would be well, I think, to correct that in some way, and I guess this is probably as good a way as any, strikes me.
Well, it was carefully considered by the committee, which is a balanced committee made up not just of plaintiffs or defendants' lawyers.
What committee considered?
Procedure and practice.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Gardner.
The discretion is whether or not to include an attorney fee award. May include at the discretion of the court, as used in the this chapter, prevailing party may include at the discretion of this of the appellate court any party who obtains a substantial modification.
Yes.
The discretion is over whether to include that that appellant, to deem that appellant a prevailing party.
Right. And whether the discretion is whether the result is a substantial modification of the judgment below,
mm-hmm. but once
so that it, the discretion could be exercised.
Once that decision is made, then presumably there is a right to a reasonable attorney's fee for the appeal.
That's correct.
Well, no, just a minute, Mr. Chairman. That would only be true, of course, if attorney fees were a part of the contract, reasonable attorney
right.
fees.
Right,
or a statute.
Or a statute.
Yeah, you don't see what I'm getting at.
I'm sorry.
Okay. There is, let's say, there's a $300 difference in the award, and that's deemed to be substantial. Now, and the judge has exercised, he or she has exercised his discretion, her discretion, to determine that is a substantial change in favor of the appellant. Does that then entitle the appellant to, quote, a reasonable attorney's fee, unquote?
Yes.
Which could well exceed the amount of that change.
Well, that's right, but my partial answer would be that probably $300 would not be considered in the discretion of the court a substantial enough modification to carry with it those larger attorney's fees, which you correctly say could be awarded if the court determined otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where the importance of the discretionary language comes in.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is that court would only award reasonable attorney's fees if they were, you know, specifically provided for by either agreement.
Oh, yeah, yeah, certainly.
So in most of the cases, what, 90% of all cases?
Sure, you're not going to get attorney fees at all. Well, I don't know. It seems to me that, you know, I think we have a policy that we do want to try to achieve finality as much as possible at the trial court level, and I do think this is going to encourage more appeals because people will think, well, even if I can just get it down, get the amount down enough, get the amount of the award down enough, I may recoup my entire attorney fees on appeal.
Well, that's a question that I don't think was discussed at the committee level or otherwise. I personally feel that the rigidity of the present rule is a much worse result than the possibility of the problem that you present.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at your committee, and I know your name, but I'm not sure.
Norman Winslow.
Yes, I see it here, and I heard you say it, but I also know it from somewhere else, and I can't remember where. But where are you
from? Well, I came and talked to you about a previous bill involving attorney's fees on appeal a couple of years ago.
Maybe that's why I remember you. Remember your name.
Mm-hmm. You were I'm not trying to sell any apples, but you were very helpful to me on another project in a closely allied area.
Well, I noticed that there are a number of lawyers on your committee that have worked on this, and it's a wide spectrum.
Yes, that was what I meant to say, that yeah. I think it's the intent of the bar structure to so create a committee of this importance.
Was this something that you talked about?
It's good enough for Steve Blackhurst. It's good enough for me.
Is this something you spent quite a bit of time talking about? You say this one issue didn't come up, but sometimes we talk a lot more depth about some issues than others. Was this one you went into quite a bit? Or?
Well, not the one based on the question.
No.
I think the committee felt, not because it was Judge Denneke, but we thought U.S. Bank versus Smith is a bad result, and the way you get around it, as best we could figure out, was by language that we have recommended in the proposed bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Superintendent Gardner.
Let me just ask Rusty, did Steve Blackhurst and Mr. Van Valkenburg support this proposal?
Do you I believe it was approved unanimously.
I it's can't. Good enough for them. It's good enough for me. Mr. Blackhurst is one of my partners.
I was going to ask a couple of names on here, but I was too embarrassed.
Well, I do not recall any dissent in the committee from what came out of it on this, nor were any questions asked at the state bar meeting in which the recommendation of the committee was approved by the state bar at large.
Well, prejudgment interest passed there, too.
Well, I admit that's more controversial. Well, I'm not prepared to discuss that subject.
No, I wouldn't want to get us off on that. I shouldn't have even brought it up. Thank you very much.
I think it's all right.
I feel a lot better about it now. I've heard more about it. Well, I don't know if I feel that good, but sure.
What the heck?
If everybody's else is ready.
Yeah, it's all right, I think.
Early in the day.
Move it out to the floor, do pass.
It's early in the day.
Discussion of Senator Gardner's motion to move House Bill 2306 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Before you got here, Senator Hendrickson, the concern arose that a bill that would say if you got a substantial modification on an appeal, if there were statutory or contractual attorney's fees allowed, that you could be the prevailing party, whether or not you'd been the plaintiff or the winner in the trial court. And Senator Gardner and I were asking Mr. Winslow if that might not cause defendants to appeal more often and clog the court. But he said they hadn't discussed that particular issue, but that there was a case that gave a particularly bad result that made this august committee feel that they should, that this was a worthy change. And there's a wide spectrum of people on the committee.
So it'll be up to the judge to determine whether it was a substantial reduction.
Yeah, it's up to the appellate court to decide that. Okay. Senator Frye, who usually opposes giving judges more discretion, said he would reluctantly go along with this.
I might mention, I believe this also was approved, Diana may want to correct me, at the bar convention. So this is not just a committee recommendation. The bar convention did approve submitting this bill.
Mr. Winslow said that.
Dissent.
Mr. Winslow pointed that out, and then I facetiously mentioned another subject.
Prejudgment interest. Approved. The summary, Mr. Chairman, the staff measure analysis has the praise the horrible of the defendant that gets the judgment knocked down from $10,000 to $100, but still loses the day because the plaintiff gets the judgment for $100 and ends up paying the plaintiff's attorney's fees.
Some of that just doesn't.
And the old rule.
No, it just doesn't grab me at all. Please call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye. Now, motion carried. Now, before we decide who's going to carry this, is this going to be perceived as a bill that gets lawyers attorney fees?
Yes.
Senator,
in
can be
view
a
of that, bill. I wonder if Senator Monroe would be willing to carry this.
Maybe we could attach it to that one that Senator Day is going to be carrying on property tax. Or is that one to register?
Maybe Mr. Winslow, where is your law officer?
Here in Salem.
In Salem. Maybe you could talk with Mr. Day about how good a bill this is.
Do you think anybody can convince Layman of that? If you're serious, I'll be glad to do it. But I detect a certain amount of weight. Yeah, well,
Layman, yes. Senator Day, no.
We laugh because it hurts too much to cry. House Bill 2888, referring to offers of compromise.
Well, I guess I identified myself in every purpose, in every respect, except with reference to the record. I'm Norman K. Winslow, again, appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Bar and as a member of the Procedure and Practice Committee. I am less familiar with this particular bill than the previous one that I just discussed for you. I'm somewhat of a pinch hitter, but I could be wrong, like prejudgment interest, but I don't believe what the the committee, and again, the committee recommendation was approved by the entire state bar. The problem originally before the committee was the matter of clarifying what was included in the offer of compromise when you made one. There was some doubt under the language of the previous rule as to whether attorney's fees or costs or interest were included in the offer. And this is one that the committee did talk about and have some disagreement originally about whether the language of the proposed bill is the solution. But our ultimate conclusion was that it was, that when you're making an offer of compromise, you don't want to have to fool around with whether or not the claimant's attorney has done a lot of, assuming it's a situation where attorney's fees could be recovered in addition to the amount of the claim, you don't want to have to fool around with or guess as to how much time or what would be a reasonable attorney's fee for the plaintiff. What you want to be able to deal with is the value of the claim. And the purpose of the present statute is to make that clear, and it provides, of course, that unless agreed upon otherwise, why, you'll just be dealing with the value of the claim. And when we got through dealing with that particular subject, we concluded that really the theory behind the offer of compromise statute would be better served if we required that it be done 10 days prior to trial rather than 3 days, so that you really wouldn't be so close to the trial that it would be hard to use the procedural device as a method of getting rid of the litigation. Nobody dissented from the idea that the rule ought to be amended to change it to 10 days. There were some people who weren't completely satisfied, but I think the committee ultimately concluded that this would be a good procedural step that would clarify the law and avoid controversies that might arise after people thought they had compromised a case or something of that kind.
This agreed upon otherwise, in addition, that's, I have to apologize, I was kind of catching up with 3-day, 10-day while you were, you explained the issues in reverse order to what I was, how I was grasping what the bill was about.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can ask a question that will clarify.
Senator Brown.
I'm not sure I understand why, how the moving it back from 3 days to 10 days tends to encourage compromises. Maybe that, if I knew that, we could see how the mechanism works.
Well, maybe I misstated myself a little. I believe we thought that if a serious effort to compromise was going to be attempted, it ought to be done far enough that if you wait till the 3 days before the trial, people are in the process from both standpoints of trying the case and preparing, and you're kind of up against the gun, and it's difficult for the lawyers on both sides, and that by making it 10 days, it would be far enough ahead of the trial to give lawyers on both sides a little more time to give serious consideration to the offer and presumptively maybe accept more of them than they would if it's virtually on the eve of trial by the 3-day rule.
Kind of a countdown sort of theory. By the time you're within 3 days of launching some sort of thing, it's pretty much on track. You can't back out.
Right. You're in the middle of preparation. You don't really want to, at least most of the time, unless you're awfully anxious to settle.
You're emotionally committed.
Yeah, right. That's the thinking of the committee with reference to that change.
Okay, I can see the wisdom of that, but initially I couldn't.
Oh, I'm also advised that that's the federal rule, which would be probably another good reason to have it in our state rule. Not that I'd adopt that generally, but uniformity between it in this kind of a situation, I think, is advisable.
As
William Jennings Bryan's mother had something good to say about everyone, and after the devil was chastised, she said, if we all kept as busy as the devil, we'd get a lot further. So you can't say something good about the federal rule.
Right.
Are there further questions? Counsel.
Yeah, I just want to point something out to the committee. The House amendments included Section 2, which has to do with if in fact this were adopted, to what actions this would be applied. That section, this has been drawn to my attention by the House Counsel, is in conflict with ORCP 1C, which is a general rule of application. And so we may want to go ahead and delete Section 2 in favor of allowing ORCP 1C, which provides that amendments to the rule shall apply to all actions pending at the time of or filed after their effective date, except to the extent that in the opinion of the court, their application in a particular action pending when the rules take effect would not be feasible or would work injustice. And that's the general application rule in the Rules of Civil Procedure.
What was that again?
Well, it's just that Section 2 of the House amendments is in conflict with the general application rule in the Rules of Civil Procedure. So the recommendation would be to delete Section 2 of the House amendments.
That was discovered more recently.
Right.
Than the House
right.
action.
Right. And I talked with counsel for that committee today about this issue.
Okay.
There he is. Okay. Mr. Chairman, on the basis of that, I will move to delete Section 2 from the
House
bill.
Okay. Is there a discussion of that motion?
That's acceptable to the sponsors?
I really am not familiar. That was not discussed.
Yes.
Okay, the answer is yes.
All right.
I've done some coaching.
Co-pilot.
What about Section 3? Does that remain now?
Correct. The reason we want Section 3 is that there's another package of changes to the and new rules of civil procedure, all of which become effective on January 1. This would make it consistent with that other package.
I knew of that in a broad general way, but I hadn't thought about it in relation to this particular bill.
Is there objection to Senator Brown's motion?
With the appropriate renumbering.
Correct.
If not, it's adopted.
Chairman, I move that we send House Bill 2888 out to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Okay, discussion. If not, call the roll on Senator Brown's motion to send House Bill 2888 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Brown?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hendrickson? Wired.
Aye. Motion carried. House Bill 2304.
Oh, yeah, that's a good bill.
Diana Godwin for the Bar Association. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I forgot to sign up. I'm going to be pitch hitting today for the chairman of the Antitrust Committee. Couldn't be here today on this bill. This is a bill that was adopted by the full Bar Convention last September. It came to us from the antitrust section of the state bar, which contains both plaintiffs and defense lawyers. The bill was not controversial on the committee, nor was it controversial on the floor of the bar convention. It does simply two things. It amends ORS 646.780 to delete a current provision, subsection 2, which seeks or purports to limit the jurisdiction of the federal court in taking an antitrust action in federal court. I believe there's general agreement that the state courts cannot limit the jurisdiction of the federal courts.
That's undoubtedly invalid.
Yes, which is why.
That explains why everyone was so enthusiastic about this law in 1975.
Well, so the bill would delete that provision and also would amend in section 2, ORS 646.140, to, for the first time, specify what the statute of limits is.
I thought it was 4 years always.
Pardon?
I always thought it was four
years. It's 4 years in the federal courts, right. But it's never been specified in the state law for state antitrust actions, and of course that creates confusion. And so the choice of the antitrust section was to conform it to federal law, right, because people are generally familiar with that and prevent confusion.
All the antitrust lawyers, at least.
Well.
Yeah, I always assumed, up and down, I always assumed it was 4 years. So it's it has been, I suppose, unlimited, or what? What was it? Who knows?
I don't know. We thought we ought to clear that one up, particularly for the professional liability fund. That's obviously a concern whenever the statute of limits is in doubt or not, you know, not clearly stated in the statute. I have the members of that antitrust section.
This probably is, Mr. Chairman, is, if anything, a plaintiff's bill, I suppose, in that it would limit, it would eliminate that bar.
Yes, if there was any...
Super bills that we...
Well, I guess that's right. I think it's all right.
Nice,
simple trial. Okay.
Senator Fry moves House Bill 2890 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Please call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye. Motion carried. Now, if we don't have a bunch of bills, we're going to... carry. We should probably get two people in energy and environment. Kathy, could you let the people in energy and environment know that we're going on to the work session now, and they might want some of these bills? I think they're concerned about Senator Cohen and Hamby.
Are you going to do that capping bill tonight, Senator Hamby? Saw me in the hall and mentioned she was particularly interested in that. And then she thought there was a 414, but I don't see that.
I don't see the capping bill on the agenda here. I don't know what gave her the notion we're going to take that up.
I don't know.
The thing that the bill that we're going to have to really use a lot of finesse to keep from taking a lot of time on is going to be Senate Bill 150. But I think Senate Bill 421, we can find out real fast what we're going to do on that. Unless Senator Gardner wants to try and get someone else here.
What's 421?
Isn't that the one you want to try and move off the table to put the 12-hour
empowerment? Can we wait till some other people get here?
Okay. Then there are these four... landlord-tenant bills coming out of the Brown-Fry subcommittee.
Do those?
Why don't we do those now?
Can we do those now?
Excellent.
Are you gentlemen ready to report? Okay. Charlie Hales is sitting on the edge of his seat because he has a different report, I think. I imagine you guys will get him all satisfied by the time you explain what you've done. I hope you do. Who wants to go first? Have you broken the bills up between you?
No, we've not. Which ones? We just have to kind of wing it here.
Is the best one to start with 395?
That's what I'm looking at.
Okay. Milt Schofield told me earlier today he thought these bills were ready to go, pretty much.
I think they are. I'm just trying to review them.
there's agreement by the subcommittee on three of the bills and a disagreement on only one.
Could we just go for the ones where there's agreement first?
Is 395 one of the ones you agree on?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Is it the 622.83 mock-up that you agree about?
The issue there, Mr. Chairman, is the the problem of in a mobile home park, under the current law, the landlord has to give 24 hours notice if he's going to come upon the rented lot in order to do maintenance, like, for example, repair a park fence that has been blown down, or repair a tree that's where the limbs are sagging toward a power line, something like this. And there's been some instances where the manager has come on the premises without the 24 hours notice, and the park introduced this bill in order to some extent relieve the manager of that duty of 24 hours notice. The MOASTA felt that there should be some continued notice, and the language that has been compromised out on lines 24 and 25 says, let's see how it reads here, in the case of a mobile home park, and this distinguishes it from other rental property, the landlord may, upon less than 24 hours notice to the tenant, during reasonable hours of the day, enter upon the rented space for the purpose of normal maintenance without maintenance only. So it's I'm trying to see how that kind of compromises the contending parties here, but it seemed to be they were both happy with it, and that's I guess that's how we came out.
Well, right now, under the law, you've got to give 24 hours written notice, even if you want to go on a mobile home space to patch up a broken down fence. Under this bill, in a mobile home park, you still have to give notice, but you don't have to give a 24-hour notice. You just give a notice during reasonable hours. Say, I'm going to go back in your backyard and fix a fence.
Okay, upon less than 24 hours notice. So the point is, if it's an emergency, you can come on right away. If it's for normal maintenance, you can come on with less than 24 hours notice, but you still must give some notice. So basically, the manager can knock on the door and say, your fence has fallen over, or your tree is sagging on the power lines. I'm going to go back there and fix it. And the landlord and the tenant says, yeah, it makes me feel good, because if people wander around in my backyard, I get worried. So they got off the 24 hours requirement, but there's still some requirement for notice. And generally then, the tenant, if he sees somebody wandering around the backyard, he knows it's not the landlord. He knows it's a stranger, and he has to be a little apprehensive. I think that's it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gardner.
Now I remember this bill. This is the one that Charlie Hales came to see me about, isn't it? This is the bill. They've got another idea of view on this.
What's that?
Which is, I think that they ought to be able to go onto the premises without notice, but not into the mobile home, into the curtilage or whatever you want to call it.
Yes, into the backyard.
Into the backyard. And they say the reason is when they're inspecting for, they're not peeking in the curtains or anything, but it's when they're inspecting for fallen limbs and that kind of thing. They don't want to knock on the doors. Is that it, basically?
Yes, they want to be able to come on for legitimate repair purposes without knocking on the door. And the OSTA people don't want anybody wandering around the yard without first a little notice. So it's a question of
notice.
Has Senator Gardner described your concern? Yes, sir. Yes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, he did.
Thank you.
Senator Brown now moves the amendments to Senate Bill 395. Council.
There are two other issues.
There's one on the back.
Oh.
No.
Quite a big one.
This has to do with the problem when the tenant is late in paying, and he comes in with partial rent, and the landlord wants to receive the partial rent. He wants to get anything out of this guy because he's afraid he's going to go south. But he doesn't want to waive his rights to ultimately terminate the rental agreement for non-payment. And basically this, as I understand it, permits him to receive a part of the rent without waiving his rights to ultimately evict for non-payment of rent during that particular month. And there wasn't any disagreement with part of either ASTA or the park owners on this issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gard.
Do I understand correctly that the only controversial, quote-unquote, to whatever extent that's controversial, is the notice provision?
That's right.
Counsel?
Well, also, this bill was originally filed at the request of the Mobile Home Park Association, and the subcommittee did, I believe, recommend to delete Section 3, which has to do with termination of a rental agreement when the tenant who resides alone dies. In your files are... There's a letter from a law firm objecting to that, and it was discussed at length in the committee.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Frye,
add to this now. One of the problems that the mobile home park owners have is somebody doesn't pay his rent, so he gets a notice to vacate, and then a day or two later he comes by and he's got the rent.
Or part of it.
And if the landlord takes the rent, why, of course, he can't proceed with the eviction proceedings, or if he takes even part of the rent. And so this part of the bill here provides that by accepting the rent that is in fact due, the landlord is not waiving his rights to evict because of the non-payment of rent. And then it goes on and says that the landlord and the tenant, if they've got any other understanding, they can put it down in the written agreement, and that'll prevail. But otherwise, under the present law, the landlord is going to lose 30 days' rent for sure.
I thought it was if that you didn't lose your right to evict for reasons other than non-payment of rent.
Well, if you evict for non-payment of rent and then you accept any
right,
rent,
you waive
that.
But you can still accept for not you can if you're evicting for some other reason you've yeah. got a disturbance or a whatever.
Right.
You can accept the rent without
That's
waiving
right.
the eviction.
That is right.
But it's acceptance of partial rent after. It's the acceptance of partial rent before notice.
Or if they say, I'll take partial rent, but I can still evict you if you don't pay the rest of it under this little supplemental agreement we're making here that you'll pay it all on payday or something, then you can
yeah.
still evict them under this bill.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you agree.
If you agree.
Sure. I knew you were going to get up here.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Charlie Hales again. We agree with the subcommittee's, but I think the subcommittee's intent was on this language, that is, that mobile home park owners be permitted to accept rent for partial payment, and let me get back to that in a minute. I will be brief. For cases other than non-payment of rent. After several readings, however, I'm not yet convinced that the language on lines 9 through 28 of page 2 do that. The scenario that we had in mind was as follows. On the 26th of this month, I have a tenant in my park who rides his motorcycle through the hedge, thereby violating his rental agreement. I give him a notice on the 27th that 30 days from now I'll terminate his tenancy. Under current law, as we understand it, I can't accept rent from him on the 1st of July, because that would waive my right to terminate. If he doesn't pay his rent, there's some question as to whether or not I should proceed to evict him for non-payment on the 10th. Therefore, our original proposal on lines 5 through 8, and I understand that that's flawed because it interferes with evictions for non-payment of rent, was to allow acceptance of rent for the remainder of the tenancy. What I believe the subcommittee's intention was to allow us to accept rent for the remainder of the month or the period or whatever was left, except in cases of non-payment of rent. But I don't know if lines 9 through 28 do that.
The way I read it, it did.
We have a legal aid attorney who's an expert in a little bit home law. Well, maybe. Chair.
Michael Marcus.
Michael Marcus, legal aid. This language is the result of a proposal I made, which then filtered through legislative counsel and came back as it is now. As I read this language, I don't think that there's any doubt but that it does two things. One is, in the event that the eviction is based on something other than nonpayment, the scenario that Mr. Hale just gave, the landlord can accept rent for the remainder of the month without waiving the right to evict for cause by that acceptance. And the landlord is entitled to rent for that period under present waiver law. Under 91.830, as it now reads, there is a very good argument that there is a waiver by accepting the rent. It's also designed to do something else, and that is to permit a tenant and landlord, a tenant to pay and a landlord to accept less than the full rent before serving a non-payment of rent eviction notice. It's our experience that there are cases that are forced to eviction where the landlord and tenant are fighting over a full month's rent, where if the landlord could have felt comfortable in accepting a little payment towards the rent, that would never have led to an eviction because the tenant would have been able to pay it in a couple of installments. And the landlord would have accepted that had the landlord not feared losing the right to evict for non-payment of rent. So the approach there is to say, before you give a written non-payment notice, you can accept part of the rent and still serve a non-payment notice if the tenant doesn't come up with the balance as agreed. If you've given the non-payment notice, then you waive the right to evict for non-payment by accepting partial rent unless you say otherwise in writing. So the service of the non-payment of rent notice is the demarcation. But
Mr. Chairman?
Where
is the part, Michael, that says that the landlord does not waive the right to terminate for breaches other than non-payment of rent? Where's that change in the law?
Well, the existing language you see, remove the bold face, acceptance with knowledge of a default by the tenant, etc., constitutes a waiver of the landlord's right to evict. That's current law.
Right.
So, and
the current law prohibits
right.
acceptance. I mean, it makes it a waiver if you accept rent after a notice of eviction based on some ground other than non-payment.
Right. Okay, so then we have new subsection 1, which says accept as provided otherwise in the section. A landlord waives the right to terminate for a particular breach if the landlord accepts rent with knowledge of the default
right.
or performance that varies.
Right.
But subsection 2, which is the accept, landlord does not waive the right to terminate as described in subsection 1 if the landlord and tenant agree otherwise after the breach has occurred. And 3, which is another exception, a landlord's acceptance of partial rent for a rental period is not a waiver under subsection 1 of this section of right to terminate the rental agreement during the rental period for non-payment if. I see what you're saying, the for non-payment.
Mm-hmm. I don't see the exception.
Yeah.
I've not yet found it, which is why I brought this up.
I know what the intent is, but I don't see it in the language here.
No, I think if you scratch for non-payment. If you scratch for non-payment, I think you get the...
Line at 19.
Yeah, on line 19.
Except, Mr. Chairman, Charlie Hales again... that it refers in subs A and B to termination for non-payment of rent, which is ORS 91.820 sub 2. The whole set of amendments seems to consume itself, chewing on its tail until it disappears.
Well, except the subsection A,
needs to go back or something.
There's two categories. If we take out non-payment, I think it still works.
Mr. Chairman, I move this go back to subsection. That's chewing.
Well, Mr. Marcus can have an equal time here for a moment.
Yeah.
And Michael can work it out. I'm sure he can get the language for us. Or it doesn't have to go back to subcommittee. How about if Michael
works? Promise legislative counsel.
Right.
I mean, that's the process that keeps coming
out. I'm sure you guys can get the right language.
Yeah, could
What's
you
your pleasure?
Could you two work on it a few minutes and bring it back to us?
Sure. Okay. Except you're now going to talk about the other bills that we're going to be doing this on.
Well,
hopefully, Senator Brown and I can explain it more adequately so we don't have to have you guys back again.
But this does not, Mr. Chairman, this does not appear to do what the subcommittee intended to do.
But we had hoped it did.
Senate Bill, is 493 the easy one of the three?
Yes. That is it. That's it. That's close to, it'll be close to your heart, Mr. Chairman, and wake us all up.
The mock-up looks pretty choppy here.
This is the right to go in and lead political literature in mobile home parks bill.
Where have I heard of this
Oh, God.
Introduced at the request of Vernon Cook.
No. Quasi-public property. Here we come again.
Where's Cheryl Perrin?
Oh, let's add shopping centers into it.
And
I'll
banks.
For that.
You got four votes.
Okay. I thought we should enact that.
What it provides on Section 1 says that the owner shall not prohibit or unreasonably restrict access to the park for purposes of non-commercial communication with park residents directly relating to the exercise of electoral rights. Electoral rights, not...
Well, Mr. Chairman...
Senator Gardner.
I don't believe that you can distinguish under the First Amendment on the basis of content, such as you are attempting to do in this bill, between speech rights for political activities and for non-political activities. Assuming that you can distinguish between commercial and non-commercial, which I believe you can.
Well, we're just solving one problem at a time.
Yeah, but I don't think you can... make that kind of distinction between that would discriminate against, for instance, religious solicitors and political
That's
solicitors.
That's commercial, isn't it?
Well, but, as I said...
However, Mr. Chairman, it seems like implicit in what he just said was the fact that anybody, for any reason, can go in and solicit a mobile home park, and I don't think that's right.
Oh, I know that's not right.
No. Oh. We know that Jehovah's Witnesses always win, so that's not...
At least let people run for elective office into the mobile home parks, and if there's somebody selling vacuum cleaners that wants to call it unconstitutional, we'll worry about that later.
Yes.
It's not the vacuum cleaner. Well, as I said...
What's your motion? I don't care. Now, included in this, of course, would be the door-to-door canvassing, pamphlet distribution... political plan distribution, the solicitation of petition signatures,
kissing babies,
soliciting lawn sign locations, those sorts of good things. Down in you'll notice we've amended in non-commercial communication, which is protected under the section down in line 12, and then in the subsection 3 starting at line 14, it says, entering or remaining on a mobile home park for the purpose described in this section does not constitute a civil or criminal trespass, but the owner has the power to right to prohibit or an owner who prohibits or unreasonably restricts communication is civilly liable. The amount is $200 of the amount of the actual damage, whichever is the greater. So there's a kind of a $200 minimum. The owner does have the right to provide reasonable regulations to avoid unreasonable annoyance or inconvenience with park residents or to avoid damage to park facilities. So this is aimed at the mobile home tenant who wants to go door to door within the park, as they've tried to do in the past to circularize and get petitions signed, and it permits the
candidate from the outside to go in on a door-to-door basis. It was interesting to note in our first hearing, Mr. Hales indicated, and the park owners who were there said they have no problem whatsoever of people coming in with literature if it is addressed to tenants. The U.S. Post Office may have an objection, but... this bill, however, is broad enough to include going to every door with literature.
It's the candidate's right to knock, Bill. It's just as simple as that.
That's right. Don't knock, you're right.
And actually, Mr. Chairman, I don't think, Jim, that it really does have any constitutional problems, because we're not allowing something on the one hand and prohibiting a different class on the other hand. We're just simply saying that one class can do this, and I think your constitutional problems come up where you discriminate in the same law between classes. This doesn't do that. It simply recognizes candidates' rights to do this, and we're not prohibiting anybody else from doing it in this bill. We're just saying we recognize the candidates at least have a right to do it.
The record should reflect we were talking about door-to-door for registration of voters, petitions, both by outsiders and insiders.
Of course, you folks in metropolitan areas don't run into this, but in the rural districts, you know, we have a lot of mobile home parks, and I know that I've heard it discussed by candidates about how they can't get into mobile home parks, and some of them are pretty good size, and I think it's important to put it that way.
I never do anything that's undignified as going door to door myself. Mm-hmm. I think it's a gross invasion of privacy.
You don't even go door to door, huh?
I think it demeans the whole political process to have people going around.
Rely strictly upon first class mail.
Pestering citizens. Senator Brown moves the amendments dated 6/22/83. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
I object.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion carried.
Chairman, I move, I recommend.
Is there some way you think we could amend this to take care of your, I know that you aren't opposed to the general idea of the bill, Senator Gardner, from the past. Experiences with you. Is there some way we could think we could fix this?
No.
You could vote for it?
No.
Electoral and religious?
No.
Rights?
No, I'd suggest you just pass it.
Okay. Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 493 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Please call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye.
Gardner?
No.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye. Motion carried. I was going to argue to vote against that because we didn't add the
shopping center. I think we should add the shopping center. I think that people on common areas should be able to express their religious views. Their
one world at a time.
Political views and whatever.
You and you're in good company in that with that flaming liberal on the United States Supreme Court, William Rehnquist.
You
said in the Pruneyard decision that it was...
Well, that's what, but we need to implement it. Unless we implement it, people can't do it. I was very disappointed last session that legislation didn't get around. I'd sort of forgotten about the whole thing until this bill came.
Okay, maybe Senate Bill 495.
Where is it?
Section 1 is being...
I don't have that bill, Mr. Chairman. There you go.
495?
We must have dropped
495?
It.
495?
Or is that the one we were... That's not the one we were just talking about.
No.
What about 494?
That's the one that we don't agree on.
Oh, okay.
Who wants to save that?
495. You don't have it in your file?
I don't have that. That was not in my file. Unless I put it somewhere else.
The 495 was introduced again at the request of the Oregon State Tennis Association. It was a committee bill. There's some small difference of opinion as to whether Section 1 should be left in this bill or put into Senate Bill 492, but there's no controversy over the contents of Section 1. But at the moment, this has been deleted from this bill, at least that's the basic proposal. And I think it's best to take it out and just handle essentially one problem with this bill. Section 1, as amended, starts down on lines 25, and it basically says that the owner of a mobile home park shall, and on the backside, this is all current law, do all of the following, and then we get down to line 25, and this is new language, as I understand.
Line 21 is new language.
Hey, pardon?
Line 21.
Isn't subsection 7 all new?
Okay, it's new, but
yes.
Okay, it's darker than the rest. Okay. It says, and that's one of the controversial areas here, shall not lease any lots within a mobile home park to a recreational vehicle unless that particular area has been designated in a kind of a separate area apart from those lots which are otherwise rented or leased to more permanent type mobile homes. The problem here is in some mobile home parks, when they have a vacancy, they do rent it to recreational vehicles who come and go in the night and cause some loss of sleep and some apprehensions. Now, Mr. Hales was concerned that this was not a good way to go because there are many of the older parks that cater to transients and people who are quite mobile, and that this would militate against the profitability of those parks. And so down in Section 3, there is a provision which, as I recall, was to Section 2 of the bill, down in the typing, it says sub G does not affect any rental agreements for the use of lots